ETF Prime is hosted by investment advisors of the ETF Store. This program is for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. Investing in ETFs involves risk, including potential loss of principal. Any past performance figures discussed are not necessarily indicative of future results. The ETF Store is not affiliated with ETF.com or any of its affiliates. ETF.com's participation in this program should not be construed as an endorsement or an indication by ETF.com of the value of any ETF Store product or service. Visit ETFstore.com for more information.
Now it's time for ETF Prime, where we discuss everything you need to know about exchange-traded funds and the world of investing. Whether you're an investing expert or just starting out, Nate will help you get up to date with what's happening on Wall Street and show you how exchange-traded funds can help lower your investment costs, reduce your tax bill, and allow you to take advantage of investment opportunities around the world. And now, the host of ETF Prime, Nate Geraci.
All right, I hope everyone is staying safe, staying sane as this coronavirus situation continues to unfold. Here in Kansas City, we are now under a stay-at-home order. So pretty much everything is shut down outside of essential services, right? Hospitals, grocers, daycares. There's also takeout and delivery services from restaurants. But other than that, pretty much everything else is closed. Kids' schools have been canceled the rest of the year, at least in-person learning. All of their activities have been canceled. Soccer, track, all of it. I'm honestly not sure if my wife's going to make it over the next couple of months with the kids and nothing to do. I think she's already a bit stir-crazy. But fortunately for me, the shutdown does not include media. And so I am recording this week from the Union Broadcasting Studios in Kansas City. My hope is I'll be able to do this over the next month or so. So the stay-at-home order is for 30 days, believe it or not, and then they're going to reevaluate. But in any event, I am here this week, and I have a very special guest to discuss this entire situation around the coronavirus, Brad Loncar, CEO of Loncar Investments. Quite simply, Brad is one of the smartest people I know in the biotech space. And when I thought about putting together a podcast around the coronavirus, he immediately came to mind. And he also happens to live here in KC. So we were actually going to do this in person, but we decided it was probably best to practice proper social distancing guidelines. And so Brad has dialed in via phone. And we're going to have an in-depth conversation around everything going on with this coronavirus, COVID-19. I want to get Brad's take on the seriousness of this. We'll talk treatments, vaccines, really dig into the biotech side of the equation. And we'll also touch on the investment side as well, just in terms of where some opportunities might lie. So my plan is to take Brad as long as he wants to go. And then later in the show, I will have our usual segment with ETF.com. Drew Voros and I are going to look at ETF flows over the past week. And then I think we have to talk about this announcement yesterday that the Fed can now buy ETFs, investment-grade corporate bond ETFs, which is just unbelievable. I think if you would have told people a month ago that the Fed would be buying ETFs in late March, they would have thought you were crazy. They would have laughed at you. But here we are. Just shows you how quickly all of this has evolved. All right. Questions or comments, you can find me on Twitter at Nate Geraci, or you can always go to etfprime.com. So Brad Loncar is now on the line with me from right down the street. I can practically holler at him. Brad, really appreciate you joining me. Truly unprecedented times we're living in. I'm still amazed at the speed with which all this has occurred. Really hard to wrap my mind around, but thank you for joining me this week.
My pleasure, Nate. I am calling in from my home down the street in Lenexa. I wish I could be with you, but always great to be on the show, whether in person or on the phone. So thanks for having me back.
Well, how are you doing? How's your family doing? How are you adjusting to this new reality we're all faced with?
Thankfully, everyone here is safe and okay. You know, like everyone else, we're a little stir crazy. You know, being in home, but we'll get through this. It's a serious situation. You know, fortunately, we're okay, and that's the thing that matters.
So, look, you follow the biotech space as closely as anyone I know. I'm curious, did you see this situation coming, maybe even before everyone else did? And I know you're not one to claim to have a crystal ball, But you think about this, U.S. stocks hit record highs on February 19th. That was well after the world knew about the seriousness of this coronavirus in China. But everyone just seemed to go about their daily lives. What were you hearing before that, and were you concerned at all?
Yeah. Well, first of all, as we get started here, I want to say I am a biotech expert. I've been doing this my whole life. But I'm not a medical doctor. We're going to talk about medicines today, and given the gravity of the situation, I want to make sure that nobody out there takes anything that I say as medical advice. But let's talk biotech. And actually, believe it or not, every December 31st, I tweet out 10 predictions. And one of my 10 predictions this year was that we were going to have a pandemic scare. Now, of course, I couldn't predict when or where, and it was kind of, you know, something that I just threw out there. But these type of things are what we biotech investors think about. They actually, as scary as they are, do happen quite regularly. I mean, we went through the H1N1 saga, we went through Ebola. This one's a little more scary, but these things do happen with, you know, somewhat regularity, and as biotech investors, we have to think about them. I did not think it was going to crash the entire U.S. stock market. One thing I was surprised by, I follow China very closely. I've been to China, you know, 10 times over the last couple of years, and I kept pretty close contact with my colleagues and friends in China when it was really flaring up there. And, you know, outside of Hubei province, they really contained this pretty well in China. You know, Shanghai, for example, had 400 cases and 4 deaths. So did, you know, if you would have told me back then, would New York City be 10 or, you know, sadly, maybe even 100 times worse than that one day? I don't think I would have believed that. But these things are, you know, unpredictable, and really, you know, it really is sad how it's gotten out of control in many parts of the U.S. But we will get over this. These things are scary and feel inextricable when they're happening, but we will get over it. I am optimistic that, you know, a brighter day will come.
So, Brad, just high level, I mean, back in January, was your thought that this virus would stay mostly confined to China?
It was. You know, the places that are most connected to China, you know, I always looked at Hong Kong is really the benchmark. You know, Hong Kong is connected to China by land and culture and government and family and all of those things, and it never really flared up there. And other places like Singapore are the same situation. And I think looking back on this, the real difference maker is those Asian countries have been through these things before. And when they flare up, I think the citizens there just naturally, you know, social distancing is a new thing for us. You know, when a hurricane or a tornado is coming, everyone knows what to do. And this is really the first time something on this scale has happened to our generation. And I don't think we really knew what to do. And we're learning that the hard way now. When this happens over there, since they've gone through things like it before, they really take the social distancing seriously right away. And I think that's really contributed to really containing it in some of those places. And so I think without a doubt, one thing that's going to, you know, come out of this is we're going to be well prepared in the future when things like this happen before. I think that, you know, people aren't going to pack Bourbon Street or, you know, beaches in Florida for spring break. If something like this happens again, we'll have much more preparedness going forward. And I think that's contributed to the spread, you know, in the United States and other countries where this just isn't, you know, this just hasn't happened very much in the past.
Well, you know, you raise a really interesting point, because I think if we go back and look at the mindset before this really started going mainstream, especially here in the U.S., I do feel like there was a somewhat dismissive attitude. I heard a lot of comparisons to the common flu and how that's much worse, right? More people die from the flu every year. This coronavirus is being blown out of proportion. And what's interesting is there's still a decent chunk of people who I think feel that way. So I saw a Pew Research survey last week where 37% of Americans believe the media is greatly exaggerating the risks here. And actually, I ran a Twitter poll last week where 30% said the public's fears of coronavirus are overblown. So I guess that comports pretty well. For those people, Brad, if you don't mind, before we get into the vaccines and treatments and what's going on in biotech, I'd love to get your take on some of the arguments for why they think this is being blown out of proportion. Do you mind if I do that briefly?
Absolutely. Let's go.
Yeah, so let me rattle through these, and I'll start with the one that we've all heard, which is the comparisons to the common flu. So I went and checked the CDC website. They estimate the common flu has resulted in between 12,000 and 61,000 deaths in the U.S. alone annually since 2010. And last I checked, I think we have around 17, 18,000 coronavirus deaths globally. Now, unfortunately, that number is changing by the hour, but I think you get the point here. And then on that note of globally, so China, they have a population of 1.4 billion. They've had around 3,300 deaths, though I don't know how well we can trust that data. Maybe we can talk about that a bit later. Italy, who I think most people would agree hasn't really handled this thing particularly well, they've had over 6,000 deaths in a population of about 62 million. But, you know, I think the argument I've heard with those statistics is, you know, this is just a small percentage of the population overall. And then I'll throw one other stat at you, and I'm not going to lie. This actually came from a friend, though I did go out and Google it to try to verify it. He said 150,000 people die every day around the world from all sorts of causes. And again, we've had 17, 18,000 coronavirus deaths since January or whatever. His point is, why are we shutting down the global economy, over that? So I'll just hand that to you. Why is there so much concern over this coronavirus? You know, help people understand the seriousness of it.
Yeah, there's a couple things that make this more serious than the flu. First of all, it's more easily spreadable. We have a scientific term called R-naught, which basically tells us how many people will one infected person spread this to. So for this, we're still collecting data, so nobody knows for sure, but we think it's in between 2.5 and 3.5 people. For the common flu, it's about 1 to 1.5. And then the other thing, which is really the big factor, is how serious it is for the people that receive it. You hear a lot of, people say that, well, for most people it's mild and all of this. That's true, but the catch here is, depending on which country you're talking about, anywhere between 10 and 15% of people require hospitalization, which is vastly higher than the flu. And so what you're seeing in places like Italy, when you have big outbreaks, is it's literally overwhelming their healthcare systems. And they have more patients than they do hospital beds and ventilators. So when you combine the fact that it's more serious, we're still trying to figure out the mortality rate, but the mortality rate of the regular flu is about 0.1%. We believe that for this, it's around 1%, so it may be 10 times more deadly than the flu. So when you factor in how deadly it is and how many people it just, puts in the hospital, if you have a big surge of cases like we're going through right now, it can just totally overwhelm the healthcare system of your country. And that's what's happening in Italy today. And that's what we're trying to avoid here in the United States by doing all of the social distancing. I'm sure you all, I'm sure the listeners out there have heard this term, flatten the curve. That's what we're trying to accomplish with this social distancing. That isn't necessarily about, will less people get this? it's spreading out the amount of time that people get this so that we don't reach the ceiling of the number of beds. So that's really the key difference. Is if this just totally went out of control, if we just said, let's just let it spread and, you know, not worry about it, because it can be spread so easily, and because so many people who do get it have serious disease, it would just totally overwhelm our healthcare system and, you know, cause more hospitalizations and deaths than any society can handle.
Well, I think that's really well said. And something else that I'll add to that, I saw a Bloomberg piece where they did an analysis of the deaths in Italy. And surprisingly, they said in 99% of those deaths, there was an underlying health condition. And if you think about Italy's demographics, they do skew a bit older as well. This virus certainly appears to be much more dangerous to the elderly, although I think we're seeing more cases impact younger people as well. But my point is, you know, if you look at the sort of health situation in the U.S., it's not like we don't have a decent chunk of the population that also has underlying health conditions. And so, you know, you can't point to Italy and say, well, this was all people that just had underlying health conditions, because that exists here, too, in the U.S.
That's right. And, you know, we're learning about this every single day. The administration talked a lot about this in their press conference yesterday. By shutting everything down and collecting data from not just other countries but now our country, we're learning about this every single day. And without a doubt, you're right. It's usually people that have existing conditions and the very elderly that are having the highest mortality rates. And in the United States, it's a little controversial right now, but you're already starting to hear people talk about, can we be a little more strategic about how we handle this rather than shutting the whole country down? And we're not there yet, but that may be the light at the end of the tunnel in the coming weeks. As we learn more about this and we learn more about where it's happening in the United States, you know, clearly there's a really bad situation in New York. You know, Washington is bad, parts of Florida. But as we get more data that comes in and we learn from this, these stay-at-home orders, we might be able to be more strategic about this in the future. So that may be the resolution, at least in the short term, to all of this. So I think what we're doing today is important and will pay off. And again, I think we're going to be much better prepared going into something like this in the future, because I think it really did catch the administration by surprise. And I think, you know, pretty much all of us kind of feel like we're going through it for the first time to this degree. And the problem is nobody really knew what to do coming into this. And, you know, we're gaining experience. And, we started out from a point of complete uncertainty, and now we're getting data and we're having experience living through it, and over time that uncertainty will become a little less, and eventually we'll get through this.
Brad, before we move on, any thoughts on that data out of China? Do you trust that data? You mentioned you have friends there, you've traveled there. I gave the stat that China has a population of 1.4 billion and supposedly they've had, I'm going to put air quotes around this, you know, only 3,300 deaths. Do you think that's data that we can trust?
I do. Like any place else, when something happens on this grand scale, I think there's a certain degree of it not being perfect. But in general, I actually do. So in China, they have this social media platform called WeChat. I don't know if you've ever heard that before.
I have.
There's a big company called Tencent that does that. So I keep in touch with 100 business executives through WeChat. A lot of these are people that run major companies with, you know, hundreds and in some cases even thousands of employees. And, you know, I've stayed in close contact with them, and I will say that what I'm hearing, it does really match with the numbers. I think they had an epic tragedy in Wuhan and in that Hubei province. But, for example, most of the biotech companies are in the Shanghai area. They're all back up and running. People are working from the office, even non-essential employees. And the stories that I heard while this was going on, while sad, you know, you did hear examples of, you know, people who had employees that, you know, were stricken with this or even passed away. But for the most part, the stories that I was hearing from those people on the ground did match with the story that was coming out of the country. So you do hear a lot of things like, you know, China had 10 times or 100 times more cases than the world knew. I don't think that's true at all, at least not based off of what my colleagues are telling me. So I do think, you know, when we look back on this, we'll really say that, you know, China and some of those surrounding Asian countries really did, in fact, do a pretty good job mitigating this. So that'll be something to learn from, I think.
Well, look, regardless of where people fall on the seriousness of this, I think at this point, there's just not really much debate that it's a real issue, right? So let's talk about how we get out of this. And we know some of the measures that are being implemented, things like our stay-at-home order, social distancing, better hygiene. And then, of course, you have the science side or the biotech side of the equation, treatments and vaccines. So I'm just going to open this up to you, and then we can go from there. How do we ultimately get out of this mess?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the answer is science. Science is what's going to get us out of this. The stay at home and everything, that's called containment and mitigation. I like to say that containment is going to do the blocking, but it's really going to take science to do the tackling. And what I mean by that is, you know, even if it takes time, society needs confidence that we can, in fact, get out of this, that, you know, the biotech industry can find a solution for this, like a vaccine, so that we can really put it to bed and not have to worry about it. And importantly, now that we've been through something like this before, so that we can have the faith that if something else like this flares up, and again, they actually do quite regularly, we need to have the confidence that that our biotech companies can come up with solutions to this. So given already the economic damage and the stress that this has caused, science really is the only thing that can truly get us out of this. So I'm really proud of the biotech industry. I think companies have really risen to the occasion and are putting their best foot forward. And I think it's really our industry's time to shine.
Well, take us through some of the work specifically being done here, because I saw on Friday the World Health Organization said there's at least 20 coronavirus vaccines in development. What are you seeing right now, and what looks promising?
Yeah, so I would put development into three buckets. So, you know, people are seeing on the news a lot of technical terms, so let's define our terminology here. So the first thing you hear a lot is what you just said, vaccines. So vaccines are meant to prevent a disease from happening. And that's a pretty tough business. And sadly, that does take time. Now, there are some companies, now the good news is, in the past, vaccines used to take years and years. The Ebola crisis, for example, which happened over 5 years ago, the vaccine for that was just approved in December, 5 years later, and we have much better technologies today. So, for example, there's a company called Moderna that has a new technology platform called messenger RNA. And I won't get too geeky into the science, but the cool thing about their messenger RNA platform is once China published the RNA signature of this virus, Moderna, working with the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, was able to take that recipe for the virus and create a vaccine and dose a first patient in Seattle with that vaccine in 66 days, which is a record.
It's amazing.
So that's things like that are what gives me confidence that we are going to get out of this. Our technologies are just so much better today than they were in the past. So that's the good news, is that a vaccine is already being tested in patients. And there's actually a Chinese company called CanSino Biologics that just started a vaccine trial in China last week as well. Now, the catch is that takes, even though it's already in trials, that's going to take at least a year to a year and a half. Because, number one, you have to first test it in a few dozen people to make sure that it's safe. And then you test it in hundreds, if not thousands, of people to also confirm that it's safe and efficacious. So by the time we go through all of that, it's going to be a year to a year and a half. And also, one thing that I don't think has really been explained to the general public well enough, that messenger RNA platform that's allowed us to get into trials so quickly is not proven yet, sadly. So that company, Moderna, does not have a vaccine or a medicine on the market yet today, so we don't know if it will work. Now, it's worth trying because, you know, it was able to get us into trials so quickly, but behind them, of course, you have many other companies using other vaccine technologies that will take, you know, maybe a little longer, but are more tried and true. So we're starting out with the quickest thing and then trying everything, you know, behind that in the spectrum.
Brad, in terms of that, yeah, in terms of that clinical trial process, I'm just curious. I mean, is there anything that the government can do to help speed that up? Or is, you know, you mentioned it being a year, year and a half away. I mean, is that because of the technology behind that? Or is it because of the regulatory process? Or both?
No, it's just because that's how long science takes.
Okay.
The government has been great throughout this. And whenever an approval has been needed, is doing things in record timing. And for example, I don't want to scare people, but for example, with that, normally before you'd put it into clinical trials in humans, you'd do months of animal testing. And they actually kind of skipped that part and are doing that concurrently. They've done enough preclinical testing, and Moderna has done other vaccines to give them the confidence that it was safe, you know, to kind of skip the animal testing part. But the FDA allowed them to do that, and they're doing the animal testing and the human trial concurrently. So that's kind of an unprecedented thing that, you know, FDA is really stepping in and doing. And you know, you've heard a lot about these diagnostics tests. You know, sometimes the FDA has approved a diagnostic test within hours from a company submitting them. And, you know, those are things that literally, you know, traditionally take, you know, 8 to 10 months. So FDA has been really great about that.
Okay, so if we're still, let's say, a year, year and a half away from a vaccine, what can be done in the interim? And I'm probably going to butcher this, but I keep seeing in the news something called, is it chloroquine?
Yep, exactly. So vaccines are going to take at least a year, year and a half, maybe longer. So here's our going back to our terminology. So you have vaccines and then you have treatments. So treatments, of course, are for people who are already stricken with the disease. And there's two ways to think about treatments. The first way is what you're asking about is when you have an emergency like we have, you first throw at it whatever you already have. So it might not be perfect, but maybe it'll make a difference. So there's a lot of drugs that are being used for other things, and in some cases literally sitting on a shelf somewhere that we're throwing at this because we believe might not be perfect, but might make a difference. So the one you're asking about is the one that's been in the news a lot because President Trump has been talking about it frequently, and that's chloroquine, and there's a derivative of it called hydroxychloroquine, which is thought to be a little safer. So that's a malaria medicine. And the reason that's in the news is a lot of doctors around the world anecdotally have been using it and have said they think it's making a big difference. So in fact, I mentioned the Shanghai numbers earlier, you know, 400 cases and only four deaths. The health group in Shanghai that had treated all of those patients is a big advocate about this and published some things on that. There was the thing that President Trump is talking about is there was a small study in France that showed that this drug cleared the viral load compared to other treatments. And by the way, it's actually being used alongside an antibiotic. So right now that's being rushed. The nice thing about that is it's a pill. And it's really cheap to make. It's a generic. It's literally been around since the 1950s. So that would be an easy solution to distribute and use widely. But the jury is still out on if it works. You know, a lot of times in biotech and science, you hear anecdotes. You know, I focus on cancer a lot. You always hear anecdotes that, you know, drug is helping people live longer, and then you run what we call a randomized trial, and sometimes, sadly, the data doesn't turn out to be that way. So it's the government is doing the right thing to rush this out to New York and other places like that, but what's really important while we're giving it to people is to run randomized blinded trials concurrently so we can find out beyond a doubt whether that medicine works or not. We don't know that today. Another treatment, an existing one, this is the one that I would circle that I'm optimistic about. Gilead Sciences has a drug called remdesivir, and I think it's pretty promising. It's an antiviral, and it, in the past, has had some success against other coronaviruses like SARS and MERS. And scientifically, just the way it's designed, the what we call the polymerase that it blocks to stop the virus from replicating is similar to the structure of this particular coronavirus. So this is the one that I would really circle because it's the most promising thing that we're going to get a near-term answer to. So Gilead set up two clinical trials in China that are that we'll have data from sometime in early to mid-April, so just weeks from now. And this is another example of a drug, just like the hydroxychloroquine, that has had anecdotally, you've heard stories about this making a difference. And again, in this case, its design, you know, really makes, I think, sense. So they've got a couple studies of hundreds of patients in China going on right now, and we should hear back from that soon. The catch with remdesivir is that it's an infusion, and you need to take it over the course of 10 days. So it might not really solve our hospital bed problem, but, you know, this anything we can do for a psychological win, I think, would just be so important. It goes back to what I was saying earlier about part of our problem today is we're at peak uncertainty. You know, we don't know what the worst case scenario is, and everybody's worried that they're going to catch this and, you know, maybe die or, you know, something. So if a company like Gilead can say, we ran, you know, a couple randomized trials, and we can say for X percentage of patients, this is making a difference, the psychological impact that would have, I think, on all of society and, you know, the stock market could be quite significant. And in this case, we expect to have this answer in the coming weeks. So to me, it's the most promising thing that will have some sort of near-term news that I would really circle. And, you know, Gilead is already ramping up the production of this. And, you know, I think they really believe that, you know, something is going on here. we'll have to see. So I would watch that. So we've talked a little bit about these things where, you know, we're throwing at this disease current drugs that we believe might work but aren't tailor-made for it. The last category we have to think about, which I'm really optimistic about, is there are dozens and dozens of companies trying to invent new medicines that are specifically designed for this problem. Now, the catch with those is it's kind of like the vaccine. You know, it's going to take a couple years to really test something to prove that new medicines are safe and effective. But I think there's a couple promising things. And the one that I would circle here is there's a great company called Regeneron. And they've done a really cool thing. They've spent literally decades trying to change the immune system in mice so that they have essentially a human immune systems. And they did this with Ebola and were very successful. So they take these mice with these human immune systems and they challenge them with this disease or this virus. Those mice make antibodies, and then Regeneron uses those antibodies to make treatments. And the cool thing about this technology is, depending on how high you dose it, it can be used either as a vaccine, so in a low-dose case, or as a treatment itself for people who are really stricken with it. And again, they had success using that process that I just described with Ebola. And I think, in my mind, there's nobody that does better science than Regeneron, and so I would watch this. So they announced that they're going to be in human trials with that technology in the early summer, and you know, it really goes back to how proud I am of companies. I think if you would have conceptually asked a company like Regeneron, you know, if something like this conceptually would have come up, how long would it take you to get into a trial? I think they would have said a year or so, and you know, to really rise to the occasion of this emergency, they're getting something like that into trials within months. So I think the biotech industry has really done a great job of, you know, trying to tackle this problem. So those are the three ways that I think people should really think about this. Vaccines prevent diseases and can really put this to bed forever if a successful one is developed. Sadly, we won't know for sure, you know, for over a year, but I do think whether it's a year or 2 years, without a doubt, there will be a successful vaccine made one day. It's just going to take some time. And so that's the first bucket. Second bucket is treatments. So, you know, companies are using existing medicines. There's some promising things that may have news in the short term. Again, I would circle Gilead Sciences sometime in April. And then there are companies that are working on tailor-made treatments for this that may take some time too. But I have no doubt that over the coming years, this will get tackled by science. So it's, you know, we're in the heat of the moment right now, and it's very scary and alarming, but I do not think we're going to be living with this for many, many years. I think that the biotech industry is going to come up with a solution, and it definitely, you know, they can do it. So I think there's reasons for people to be optimistic out there.
Brad, it's pretty clear that you think science is what's going to get us out of this, but is it possible that containment and all of these other steps we're taking, can those essentially snuff out the virus on their own, or you think that science absolutely has to be involved here?
Well, I think those things are buying us time. That's the way that I think about it. You know, it's that flattening the curve and causing this to, you know, not be as severe of a problem and to be more drawn out, and that buys time for science to take care of it. You know, you've heard some people say, oh, this will just burn out, you know, in the summer when warmer weather happens. I wouldn't bet on that. You know, a lot of experts are saying that they believe that this is something that will definitely come back in the fall and, in other seasons. So I think that containment can definitely make it more manageable. Look, that's what happened in China. You know, China is back to work today. They just announced last night that even in Wuhan and it is going to lift its lockdown in early April. So even the place in the world where this was truly the worst, you know, a real tragedy, is going to be back to work in a couple of weeks. So science can make a difference, but, you know, or containment can make a difference. But I really do think that science is going to be necessary because, like I said, this has caused such a global disruption. And, you know, people at home and the stock market is crashing and everything. What people need, whether, you know, containment slows it down or, you know, even appears to stop it, what people need is mental confidence that this can be tackled if it ever comes back or if something like it comes back. And the only thing that can give you 100% confidence like that is science. So I do think it's really the ultimate solution.
As you walk through the different companies here, I try to jot these down. So I had Moderna on the vaccine side, CanSino on the vaccine side, Gilead in terms of treatments, and then Regeneron in terms of these, we'll call them tailor-made treatments. But I've seen you reference quote-unquote virus stocks, and in the reference that I saw you make to this wasn't in a good way. Do you mind just talking about what virus stocks are and maybe how it compares to some of these other companies you mentioned that are doing good work in this space?
Yeah, so one thing that always happens when these things occur is dozens of companies put out press releases saying that they're working on something, and their stock prices zoom. And, you know, a lot of companies are just taking advantage of the situation. Like, if you look back at the Ebola crisis and H1N1 and now this, there are some companies that have taken advantage of all of those situations, and they always get a stock pop, and their stocks always end up crashing. And even the ones that I've mentioned, which in my opinion are the legitimate companies doing legitimate science, their valuations get out of control. You know, I don't think companies, one thing that I think what we call generalist investors, so non-biotech investors, might be surprised by is I don't think there's a lot of money in this. I think companies are getting into it for the right reason. And give you two really quick examples. So Ebola. So when the Ebola crisis happened, you know, all of these companies put out press releases and all of their stocks were zooming and everything. There was one company that if you went back in history 5 years ago, actually did have what turned out to be the successful Ebola vaccine. It's called NewLink Genetics. And 5 years ago, at the heat of this, their stock price was 50. And in December, when the Ebola vaccine was approved, their stock price was $1. So even the company that successfully, you know, if you were so smart that you picked the one company out of dozens that actually successfully did tackle this, you would have lost all your money. And so think about how you would have done on all the ones that didn't succeed. You know, as another example, the company AbbVie, that just like Gilead, has an HIV medicine that is being repurposed today, and some doctors are trying to use it for this. They just put out a statement yesterday that said they don't care about their ownership rights to that drug. Anybody in the world can make it for free today. So if any company does successfully make a vaccine or a treatment, hopefully this will be somewhat of a one-type event, and companies don't really traditionally make money on those things. And given how important this is to humanity, you know, companies aren't going to, you hear a lot of terrible things about the pharmaceutical industry, about price gouging and everything. Like, nobody's going to do that in this case. So I have no doubt that, you know, a company you know, a big company like Gilead could make a couple billion dollars on something like this, but for a company like Gilead, that's nothing. So I strongly advise, or I strongly urge caution about playing these virus plays, because when these events are over, and this will be over one day, the financial reality of this will set in for all of these stocks. So it's really a dangerous thing to do. Now, I'm a big advocate about how the healthcare sector in general is going to come out of this. I think that, you know, investing in humanity's well-being is going to be the thing coming out of this. So I think our sector as a whole is really going to have some momentum, and I'm really proud of how we're really, you know, the best of our industry is really being put on a spotlight here. So, you know, I think it's appropriate to think about healthcare as a whole as being a promising sector coming out of something like this. But if past history, and we've gone through these things many, many times, I've seen, you know, many of these as a biotech investor, if past history is any indication, people are going to lose a lot of money playing these hot, quote-unquote, virus stocks. So I strongly, urge caution in doing that.
You brought up a really interesting point earlier. For the biotech industry overall, do you view this as a potential opportunity to maybe regain some goodwill or even credibility, just given all the negative headlines over the past several years, right? The ones you mentioned, drug pricing scandals, you had the opioid epidemic, those sorts of things. Can this coronavirus situation maybe help turn that perception around?
I sure hope so, and I really do think so, and it's exactly right. I mean, so one thing I can say is, 99% of people who work in the biotech industry are smart, hardworking people who are trying to do the right thing. And those things you mentioned, drug pricing, the opioid scandal, and other nonsense, really has rightfully angered the general public and tarnished this industry's image. And I think that the public is now seeing the good side. You know, in this global emergency, everyone's turning to the biotech industry to solve this, and I think that's a huge opportunity for our industry, and I think the industry has done a great job of all hands on deck. Let's figure out a solution to this. And the reason I love being a biotech investor, we talk about all the time is impact investing, and I've always been a big believer that the ultimate impact investing is biotech. You know, I focus on cancer and other things like that. What better thing is there to invest in for society? And, you know, as I talk to people, I've always tried to frame it that way, but, you know, because of these reputation issues, people don't think of biotech in that way, and I think now they can again, especially if we find a solution to this sooner rather than later. So I think that biotech can really shine. And, I follow China very closely. There's a biotech boom happening in China. And, for example, Credit Suisse put out a great survey a couple weeks ago where they surveyed consumers in China, and they said, what are the things after this is over that you're going to spend more money on, and what are the things that you're going to spend less money on? And the top two that the consumers said they would spend more money on is healthcare and education. And the things they said they would spend less money on were, you know, things like restaurants and, you know, shopping and stuff like that. So I think around the world, healthcare really can be the sector that comes out of this with momentum. I'm very optimistic about the long term. And another thing that I think is cool is I've always felt that we're going through a really special time in science, and it's been frustrating to me that because it's a really technical thing, that people aren't seeing it. You know, you see a Tesla driving down the street, so you understand what advances in technology are happening. Well, with some of these medical advances, you don't see it in your daily life, so most people don't know about it. So as we were talking about with Moderna and this mRNA platform, you know, it used to take a year to 2 years to even start clinical trials of a vaccine. And this company, using this amazing new technology, was able to do it in 63 days. And I'm really encouraged that things like that are, you know, being shown on 60 Minutes in the nightly news, and people are starting to see some of these amazing, you know, what, as a biotech investor, I kind of felt were hidden secrets, you know, over the last, you know, handful of years of all these new technologies, you know, like gene therapy and immunotherapy and cancer and all of these things that I think are really a new era of medicine. I think the general public is starting to see some of those things through this crisis. So I think that just our the way we think about well-being we're going to place a lot more emphasis on it coming out of this, and I think a lot, you know, I think the public and the investing public are going to have a much greater appreciation of biotech and scientific advances now that they're seeing it in many cases for the first time.
Well, Brad, I think that is the perfect place to put a period on our conversation, just on an optimistic note. I've got to tell you, what a tremendous overview of everything going on in the biotech space. There's obviously a lot of fear and panic out there right now, both in the real world and certainly the financial markets. I love your perspective and the deep dive into all the encouraging things that are going on here. Really wish we could have done this in person, but still, this was fantastic. Hopefully we can get back to some semblance of normalcy soon and ultimately get you back into a studio here. But stay safe. I'm sure we'll be in touch. And thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me. Looking forward to seeing you in person in the future, too. We will get over this. Stay optimistic.
That was Brad Loncar, CEO of Loncar Investments. All right, let's chat with ETF.com's Drew Voros.
Time now for our weekly chat with the experts at ETF.com, the world's leading independent authority on ETFs.
I think we're seeing a different way of ETFs being launched. The real kicker was governance, selling of private data. They really let down their customers repeatedly.
Drew, so how are you holding up right now with this coronavirus situation? You're in the Bay Area, correct?
Yeah, we are. Everything's good. If one thing, California, I think, was way ahead of, for instance, New York in the shelter-in-place. And it's not as draconian as it sounds. Obviously, only grocery stores and gas stations and pharmacy-type places are open. But you can still walk around. You can still drive around, and public transit's open. Hospitals are open. But keeping our fingers crossed here that we blunt the curve.
Yeah, you and me both, for sure. Well, let's talk ETF flows last week, which actually weren't quite as bad as some might expect, given what we saw in the markets, right?
No, not at all. I mean, the net was $19 billion in outflows. However, equities saw a positive inflow of $6 billion, and really the outflow came from fixed income. And then again, the most recent flows we've seen, we're continuing to see outflows. But fixed income seems to be really the one that is leading in outflows. However, as we heard yesterday, the Fed is going to be injecting some money, including some into corporate investment bond ETFs. So it'll be interesting to see how that dynamic plays out, which funds they actually buy, and when that starts out.
Yeah, so I guess what impact do you think that might have on flows overall into bond ETFs?
I mean, again, it depends how big the bazooka is. There hasn't been a number. What they have set up is something called the Secondary Market Corporate Credit Facility to provide liquidity for outstanding corporate bonds. They'll purchase in the secondary market corporate bonds issued by investment-grade U.S. companies and U.S. listed exchange-traded funds whose investment objective is to provide broad exposure to the market for U.S. investment-grade corporate bonds. That's the quote from the Fed. So, again, we'll have to see how big that purchase is. We're also seeing today, it looks like we're going to get, the Congress is going to pass a virus stimulus package. So all those things, I think, will only help fixed income going forward. But the big funds that I would imagine would be the target would be the $29 billion iShares iBoxx Investment Grade Corporate Bond ETF, LQD, and the $26 billion Vanguard Intermediate Term Corporate Bond ETF, VCIT. Both of those did gain in the market yesterday. However, just to be clear, Nate, this does not include junk bonds. Mm-hmm. So there is a certain level here that the Fed is going to stop at. And we did see HYG and JNK, two big junk bond ETFs, actually fall yesterday while the investment grade rose.
Something that I thought was interesting yesterday, of course, bond ETF discounts have been a big topic of conversation. Mm-hmm. You and I have talked about that on this podcast. I mean, I still feel like overall bond ETFs have functioned properly. They've operated as price discovery vehicles. But something that was interesting yesterday was you look at an LQD or you look at a VCSH, the Vanguard Short-Term Corporate Bond ETF. Those were actually trading at premiums after the Fed announcement. And I just thought that was interesting, you know, with that money coming back into the market, those discounts pretty quickly evaporated.
And we've seen that, right? I mean, the price dislocation corrects. No one has written that anything has been broken yet because it hasn't. Things are correcting. There might be some dislocation. But look at the markets we're in right now. I mean, it's crazy. These are unprecedented times. And there's no way anybody could have ever seen this coming. And now we're seeing the ETF structure, in my opinion, continually to correct itself into the right price discovery as they were designed to do.
Drew, going back to ETF flows overall, I think one of the more surprising stats this year is that ETFs have taken in like over $70 billion, which is actually well ahead of last year's pace. And if you think about last year around this time, I think stocks were up, you know, 11-12%. Mm-hmm. Bonds were positive as well last year. What do you make of that?
I just think the market peaked early on in the year. As you said, we're at $70 billion for the year to date compared to about $50 billion a year ago. And the market appreciation has something to do with that. And I also just think people are not afraid to be in the market right now. So we're seeing folks maybe move out of fixed income. I mean, the yields are just getting lower and lower, and there's a lot of uncertainty about how that's going to work out. But there is confidence in the market, and we're seeing people not necessarily run away, but stick in the game. And obviously the next couple of weeks are going to be very, very important to see how the market just continues to play out. But as we're seeing today with the market up significantly, the Congress and the Fed are clearly stepping in with some financial bazookas.
When you mentioned confidence in the market, I mean, obviously with the markets down or stocks down 30% plus, you know, clearly there's some panic out there as well. But when I think of confidence in the market and you look at flows, I feel like the confidence has been more from the longer term buy and hold side of the equation, more of the retail side of the equation, which is interesting because the narrative, if you go back over the past few years, is that once we have a severe downturn, retail is going to panic, right? They're going to sell out of their, their Vanguard ETFs and exacerbate the market decline. But we've actually seen pretty much the opposite of that, where longer term investors are sticking with, you know, their plan, I guess, to your point, having that confidence. I just think that's an interesting dichotomy. The selling appears to be coming from elsewhere.
Yeah, and, you know, anecdotally, just from my friends and others, I mean, people are like, is this the time to get in now? Because, I mean, everything's on sale, right? Relatively speaking. So there is we always talk about how, you know, investors, you know, pull out at the wrong time and go in at the high time. But there is a dynamic out there that I'm hearing about, you know, people are ready to jump in. The question is, this is such an unprecedented time that nobody knows, is this the beginning of the end or the beginning of the rise? And maybe today we're getting a little more confidence in the markets because we're seeing the fiscal stimulus. We're seeing the Fed coming in to buy assets. And that just has to improve confidence for people. And people are ready, you know, take advantage of the market, and that's what they should do.
Something else I think will be really interesting to watch with ETF flows overall. You talk about the $70 billion into ETFs so far. I'm sure some of that is create to lend, right, where ETF shares are being created to lend to short sellers who are obviously betting against the market. But look, I think there's quite a bit of tax loss harvesting going on. And also, even more interesting, I'm wondering if this market downturn sort of helps unlock investors from mutual funds, where maybe they've hung on to some more expensive mutual funds because they had taxable capital gains, right? Mm-hmm. But if those gains have come down, or maybe they even have losses now, that makes it much easier for those investors to switch to ETFs if they were held in a taxable account. And I look back to past crises, you think of 2008, 2009, there were huge outflows out of actively managed funds and into passive and ETFs. We saw a similar thing happen in the back half of 2018 when the market was down 20%. I think you have to imagine that's another possibility here.
Absolutely. And the other thing, you hit the nail on the head. If you're going to pull out, these are the people pulling out now because you can report the losses. And that is always seemed to be sort of the linchpin, was that you're not going to get people to move out of their mutual funds because they're going to take these huge capital gains hits. So if that is the case, like I said, the next couple of weeks are going to be very interesting to just watch the entire financial market system.
Well, hopefully things will improve. If they don't, perhaps while the Fed coming in and buying stock ETFs, that would certainly help inflows. But Drew, stay safe. Take care. Always appreciate your perspective. Thank you.
Same to you, Nate. Thank you very much.
That was ETF.com's Drew Voros. That'll do it for this week's ETF Prime. If you enjoyed the podcast, we would greatly appreciate it if you could drop us a quick review wherever you listen to podcasts. That helps other listeners find the show. You can also send us comments on Twitter at ETF Prime. Next week, I have two of the very best in the ETF business. Dave Nade, Chief Investment Officer and Director of Research at ETF Trends and ETF Database, and then CFRA's Todd Rosenbluth. We're going to recap everything that's happened with ETFs during the first quarter, certainly here recently, and then also get their ETF outlooks moving forward. Until then, have a great week, everyone.